Hi, everyone. This is Dr. Cheryl Selman, and welcome to What Women Must Know, the show that empowers you with truthful information so you can make the most informed decisions possible regarding your health and well-being. And it's such a pleasure to have you with me today. This is a wonderful opportunity to gain more knowledge, to have in-depth conversations that really allow us to have an ability to get a grasp of the situation, to have practical strategies that really make a difference in our life. And today is all about getting that practical information that will really help us create greater health, support us to heal ourselves as well. So I'm just going to jump right into it. Today we are having a wonderful conversation with Dr. Michael Mosley, who's been a guest a couple of times on the show, and he is always such a wealth of inspiration and just a delight in he and how he presents the amazing research he's put together. And he has a brand new book called The 8-Week Blood Sugar Diet, How to Beat Diabetes Fast and Stay Off Medication. So if you have not heard of Dr. Michael Mosley, I'm going to just share a little bit about him. He is the number one New York Times bestselling author with Mimi Spencer of The Fast Diet, which has been published in over 32 languages around the world. He is also co-author with Peta B of Fast Exercise and wrote the foreword for the Fast Diet cookbook by Mimi Spencer and Dr. Sarah Schechner. Dr. Mosley trained to be a doctor at the Royal Free Hospital in London before joining the BBC, where he has been a science journalist, executive producer, and most recently a well-known television personality. He has won numerous television awards, including the RTS, the Royal Television Award, and was named Medical Journalist of the Year by the British Medical Association. So it's with my great pleasure that I welcome Dr. Mosley to the show today. Hello there.
Hello, hi, great to be back.
Well, it's good to have you back, and congratulations on your latest book and your latest award. You are such a fantastic inspiration, Michael. I just so appreciate the wonderful work you do because you help people create real results, and that's what we're
looking for.
So you're tackling diabetes now, and you have this 8-week blood sugar diet. Let's talk about what focused you on the diabetes issue, because I think it's actually quite a personal challenge.
It is intensely personal. It all began actually 4 years ago, and I know it was 4 years ago to today because it was my birthday. And I happened to go along to my doctor on that day and had a blood test for something completely unrelated. And she rang me up a day later to say, I've got some bad news, I'm afraid, that you are now a type 2 diabetic. You're blood sugar levels have risen above the critical level. And I wasn't even aware I was at risk, so this was a kind of nasty shock to me. And she said to me, look, it's fine, we'll start you on medication, and that will sort it out. But I wasn't convinced that would be a good thing to do, because my father had developed type 2 diabetes at around my age. And although he had started on medication and followed his doctor's advice, things simply got worse. And he ended up dying about a decade later from a heart attack, which was precipitated by the diabetes. And by that point, he also was showing signs of dementia, which again is related to the type 2 diabetes. So I thought, I don't want to go there. I've seen what the consequences are. There must be something better. And I'm fortunate because I'm a science journalist, because I have a medical background, and because I have access to some of the finest science brains in the world. So I looked around, and I came across this thing called intermittent fasting, where you cut your calories a couple of days a week. And research on that had shown that doing so, it was possible to kind of reverse conditions like type 2 diabetes, but also get other benefits. So I thought, that's really interesting. I'll find out more about that. I persuaded the editor of the BBC Science Strand, Horizon, to let me make a film about doing this. And that's what I did. And I made a film called Eat Fast, Live Longer. And in the course of it, I invented, if you like, a diet called the 5-2 diet, also known as the fast diet, which involves cutting your calories 2 days a week. And when I did that, I lost 20 pounds of fat, and I managed to reverse my type 2 diabetes. And 4 years on, my blood sugar levels are completely normal, and I've kept the weight off. So that's kind of what really got me interested in this whole area. And it also got me incredibly interested in nutrition, which I'd actually had no interest in before, because when I went to medical school, we were taught nothing about nutrition. Doctors are not taught nutrition at all. They're taught exotic things like kwashiorkor disease or nutritional deficiency diseases, but nothing about what happens when a patient sits in front of you and says, you know, doctor, I want to lose weight, or doctor, what can I do that will reduce my risk of heart disease? So this is true in America. It's true in Britain. It's still true in Britain, I know, because my son, one of my sons is training in medicine, and he received no training at all in either nutrition or exercise. And indeed, he set up a nutrition society at his university. And I've spoken to American doctors about this, and again, they say they learn nothing. They probably know less than their patients about nutrition, and so they don't really feel able to deliver information. So that's kind of got what me fired up about it, and I started reading everything I could. I got absolutely fascinated about it. I wrote the book, The Fast Diet, which became a New York Times bestseller, as you've said. It reached a lot of people. A lot of people got interested in it, and I've just been pursuing it ever since. But that book was not written specifically aimed at type 2 diabetics or anything like that. It was kind of more looking at general health. I was astonished at the time how little I knew, but also how little doctors and nutritionists knew about a lot of the discoveries that have been done by scientists in the labs and things like that. And so little of it has kind of translated to what patients, you know, can use. And I guess that's kind of what I've been doing ever since.
You know, diabetes is this huge epidemic. It's going on all over the world, but the statistics, certainly for the United States, are pretty shocking. Right now, 13% of the U.S. population, that's 30 million people, have diabetes. 86 million Americans are pre-diabetic, and the CDC estimates that 40% of the current adult population, that's 90 million Americans, will at some point develop diabetes. Those are shocking statistics, and I have diabetes in my family. I have relatives who, were diagnosed with diabetes. We're on those medications. We're not given any nutritional device and advice, and therefore they had amputations. They had heart disease. They had kidney transplants. I mean, their lives were absolutely miserable. So it really strikes home to me as well.
And that's absolutely common. It's the number one cause of preventable blindness in the U.S., number one cause of kidney failure, liver failure. It's because what happens is the blood sugar, even if you're a pre-diabetic, you're not yet a diabetic, the elevated blood sugar levels damage the arteries and the veins and the nerves, and around 73,000 Americans have a limb amputated every year because of type 2 diabetes. And in other parts of the world, it is just as bad. It is an absolute explosion. In places like Vietnam, they are now amputating more limbs because of type 2 diabetes than they were amputating limbs during the height of the Vietnam War because of mines. It has taken off in a spectacular and awful fashion right across the globe.
Right across the globe. I think India has one of the highest rates of diabetes in the world.
It does. China currently leads the pack with around 100 million diabetics, and maybe half the population are also pre-diabetic. That's half a billion people. India coming up second, and in places like the Middle East, I've just come back from Dubai, Saudi Arabia, essentially zero levels 20 years ago, now 25% of the population, a quarter of the population are diabetic.
So in your experience, what do you believe is fueling this?
I think it's essentially a combination of things. It all took off around 1980, which is actually when I went to medical school. And what happened around there is the population around the world became obsessed by the low-fat diet. The message being preached was the low-fat diet is the way to go. It will stop you putting on weight. It will stop you developing heart disease. Anyway, unfortunately, what many people then did is they took to consuming huge amounts of sugary carbs instead. What we know for certain is that just as this message, the low-fat diet, went out there, obesity rates absolutely started to soar in America and then around the rest of the world. And what we've seen now is a doubling of rates of diabetes in the States since the 80s. Same is true in the UK, same is true in Australia. Other places around the world, even higher rates. They've gone up fivefold, tenfold. So undoubtedly what is driving it is the fact we're putting on weight. and it's where the weight is going. Because some weight, for example, weight on your bottom, or perhaps weight on the breast fat there, is not a bad thing. It may not be kind of, you know, what you want, but it is either neutral or can even be protective. But the weight, it's the fat you accumulate around your tummy, around your abdomen, around your gut. That's the really bad thing. And men tend to put on more of it than women, which is why type 2 diabetes tends to be more of a risk for men than for women, but both groups are at risk. And if you have a waist which is more than 35 inches, for example, you are at significantly greater risk. And it seems to be that's because the fat which is around your middle is kind of active. And what it does is it infiltrates your liver and your pancreas. And when you get a fatty liver and your pancreas starts to get filled with fat, then they can no longer talk to each other. And your body is no longer able to produce adequate levels of the hormone insulin, which should bring your blood sugar levels down. And that's kind of when you tip over from pre-diabetes into diabetes. So it seems to be particularly that abdominal fat, which is the really bad thing. And there's also links, very strong links, between insulin and, say, breast cancer.
So what are your concerns about medications and insulin, particularly when people become insulin dependent? You know, so many people think that if they get a diagnosis of diabetes and they're put on these medications, of course not giving the nutritional advice really to any degree, they just carry on as usual thinking their medications will be the answer. But that's not so. And what should we know about the medications that are prescribed?
That's not so. And unfortunately, what doctors will tell you, which is simply untrue, is that diabetes is an irreversible condition. It's a progressive disease. And your best bet is to start on medication, and that will sort everything out. Now, I'm afraid that's kind of wrong at quite a few levels. It's a bit like having an infection. And the way I treat you is by giving you, you know, aspirin or something to bring your temperature down. But I'm not actually treating the infection. So the infection just rumbles on underneath. And I have to give you higher and higher doses of something to bring your temperature down. Because all that the drugs are doing is treating the symptom, which is raised blood sugar levels. They're not actually treating the cause. And the trouble is also that many of the drugs they give you will make you hungrier and make you fatter. So if I wanted to make you really fat, the one way I could absolutely guarantee to do that is by injecting you with insulin. Because insulin is a hormone which not only regulates blood sugar levels, but it also promotes fat storage. So basically what happens in the early days of type 2 diabetes and pre-diabetes is that you become insulin resistant, which basically means that your body has to produce more and more insulin in order to try and drive the sugar levels down. It's a bit like, you know, you shout at the kids and you have to shout them louder and louder because they stop listening to you. So what happens is the insulin levels go up, and as they go up, they encourage fat storage. Basically, they take the calories out of your blood and they stick it in your fat cells. And that means that when you're in an insulin-resistant phase, and probably about half of all adult Americans are in that phase, then you are simultaneously hungry and getting fatter because the calories are not going to your muscle and places like that. They are going into fat storage. And the result is that your brain is going, give me food, and your insulin is just dumping it constantly in the fat. So when people talk about obesity, I don't think it's a moral problem or a willpower problem. I think it's primarily a metabolic problem. It's a bit like you're driving your car around, you're running low on petrol, and you start to fill your car up with petrol, but instead of it going in the engine, in the tank, if you like, it goes in the boot of the car. So it's going in the wrong place. And the reason it's going in the wrong place is because your insulin levels are way too high. So, and the other big problem with insulin is a kind of, it's a driver of cell turnover. And we know that high levels of insulin are also strongly associated with increased breast cancer risk. So we know that simultaneously that gut fat is increasing your risk of type 2 diabetes, but it's also increasing your risk of a range of things, and in particular of breast cancer. So that's another good reason you want to bring it down. Going back to the medication, as I said, it's not dealing with the underlying disorder. The first drug you'll be put on is a drug called metformin. Now, that is one of the most widely prescribed drugs in the world now. We don't know if it actually works. We know that even if you're a treated diabetic on medication, then you cut your life expectancy by about 10 years. Now, the assumption is that metformin works, but actually there was a big study recently in the British Medical Journal, which is a very respected journal, which said, look, we don't actually have the data. The studies have been very inconclusive as to whether metformin will actually cut your risk of having an amputation or having a heart attack or developing any of the other complications of diabetes. We think that's true, but we're not convinced by what we've seen. There is no knockout argument. So I wouldn't, you know, suggest to people who are on metformin at the moment they give up, but I would suggest they seriously have a look at, you know, losing weight and doing things I write about in my book. Because without doubt, if you can lose about 10% of your body weight, then there's a very good chance that you will be able to reverse your diabetes or indeed your pre-diabetes and not need to be on medication, which will save you an awful lot of grief, and it will also save you an awful lot of money because the drugs are very, very expensive. Your life insurance will be very expensive, and your life will be cut short.
And when people are diagnosed with diabetes or even pre-diabetes, they're always told, okay, you've got to cut down your food and exercise more. But that's really hard for people to do because often these drugs are driving that, you know, insulin response, and they do start craving or they have swings in their blood sugar. And also they don't have energy. Part of the consequences of diabetes is that you're not getting the energy that your body needs. So you're tired, you're fatigued, you can't think, and you don't even know what foods are best for you and how to follow it. So it just sets up this terrible cycle of defeatism in people. They just give up trying to manage this and also knowing that they can actually heal it, which is, as you said, is often not given as an option to those people.
Always, almost never given as an option because most doctors are completely unaware of the modern research. And as one of the experts I spoke to, Dr. Roy Taylor, who is one of the leading diabetes specialists in Europe, he said you might as well hang a big sign over the door saying, give up hope, all ye who enter here, because that's the message. And the dietary advice they get is generally appalling. It's essentially to eat lots of starchy foods. And all those starchy foods are going to do is raise your blood glucose levels, pump up your insulin and things like that. So telling diabetics to, you know, eat rice, eat potatoes, eat bread, which is the common advice. Indeed, one diabetic I spoke to was advised to eat tinned pineapple three times a day. I mean, the level of advice they get from their doctors is generally absolutely appalling and is completely not in line with what modern research shows. But as I said, the problem is that a lot of doctors are not, you know, up to date with modern research. So that's kind of what makes me weep a bit. I actually have a website, if people are interested, called thebloodsugardiet.com. And we have a section in there, Things My Doctor Told Me. And this includes an awful lot of really mad, absurd things that people get told by their physician. It also has a very supportive community and lots of kind of advice on how to do the diet and how to stick to the diet and the sort of foods and recipes. So I'd love some Americans to come along and join us. We've got lots of English, a lot of Australians at the moment, a lot of New Zealanders on the site, but I need more Americans.
So it's thebloodsugardiet.com?
Yes, right, yeah.
Okay, so let's talk about the research that you uncovered and helped to shape your thinking and create.
Absolutely.
New book of yours.
So it started, as I said, originally with The Fast Diet, which is a book I wrote, and research onto intermittent fasting and the 5-2 diet, where you cut your calories 2 days a week. That was based, again, on research done at Manchester, primarily on women who are at risk of breast cancer. And what they did there is they put them on a standard diet or on the 5-2 diet, and they found that those who were on the 5-2 diet lost more weight, more fat, stuck to it, and they also reduced their breast cancer risk significantly. So that got me interested, I got in contact with this guy called Roy Taylor, who's based in Newcastle University. He's professor of medicine there. And he told me about research he was doing, which was, if you like, a sort of turbo-boosted version of the 5-2 diet. And on his diet, what you do is it's 800 calories for 8 weeks. So that sounds quite low, but he said the patients are very motivated because the alternative is to be a lifetime of medication. and so people kind of get committed. So I spent several years kind of collecting information, and then I wrote the book, which has just come out, which is based largely on his work, but also on other work. And essentially, as I said, what you do on it is you go on 800 calories a day for 8 weeks. And average weight loss in clinical trials was 33 pounds. And almost everybody stuck to the diet. And they found that if you did stick to the diet, then around 90% of people were able to reverse their type 2 diabetes. This was obviously dependent on how long you've been diabetic for, because if you've been diabetic for more than 8 to 10 years, then it was more like a 50% improvement, but everyone managed to get their blood sugar levels down and reduce all their medication. So even if you didn't quite, you know, reverse your type 2 diabetes, you did see huge improvement. So this has now been done in several hundred people, very compelling studies, very good science behind it. And my diet is based on Professor Taylor's diet. He's written the foreword. My diet is actually more of a sort of modified Mediterranean diet, because the diet which has been kind of promoted for many years is obviously the low-fat diet. And as I said originally, that has led to lots of problems, because unfortunately, you know, low-fat has never been a very convincing way of losing weight. There was an enormous American diet, which you may be aware of, which was done in the 1992 it began, which involved 84,000 American women who were randomly allocated to either a low-fat diet or just sticking to their normal habits. And they were followed for 8 years. And this was one of the most expensive trials ever undertaken. And at the end of 8 years, there was only a 1 pound difference in weight. And there was no difference in any of the other things they could measure. There was no difference in their blood sugar levels, none in their heart disease risk, nothing. Basically, the study had demonstrated that the low-fat diet was completely ineffective. They then ran a much bigger study in Spain, where they randomly allocated people who were at risk of heart disease to either going on a low-fat diet or a Mediterranean-style diet. And on the Mediterranean diet, basically, as in on the low-fat diet, they were encouraged to eat fruit and vegetables. But on the Mediterranean diet, you encourage also to eat oily fish, plenty of olive oil, splash it on your vegetables, cook with it. You're encouraged to eat lots of oily nuts and have a glass of wine in the evening and a bit of dark chocolate in the evening. And whereas those on the low-fat diet were encouraged to eat, you know, starchy foods, rice, potato, bread, pasta. And what they found is the ones on the Mediterranean diet were 30% less likely to develop heart disease or stroke. If you were a woman, you were 68% less likely to develop breast cancer, and you were 50% less likely to develop diabetes. Plus, because they did brain tests, throughout memory tests, they found you're much less likely to become show signs of early dementia or memory loss if you were on the Mediterranean diet than if you were on the 5-2 diet, on the low-fat diet. So the Mediterranean diet is a kind of a brilliant diet from all sorts of angles, but it's still not the diet that's being recommended to diabetics or indeed anyone else. Dieticians and people pay lip service to it, but in my experience, they all still describe, you know, tell you to eat lots of starchy things. And I find that completely insane. The science is out there. It's just being ignored, and that makes me quite angry, I must admit.
It makes me angry, too. I totally understand that. I think that those researchers on those 84,000 women had any background in nutrition, they could have saved a lot of money.
They could have saved a lot of money, and at the end of it, they all went, we probably put them on the wrong diet. Because, yeah. As I said, it made no difference at all. And that was part of a bigger trial. And it cost, I think, $600 million in the end, and they've just ignored the results, which is mind-boggling, absolutely mind-boggling.
That's immoral, actually, right there.
Yeah.
So when we talk about being on an 800-calorie diet over 2 months, let's talk about what are the aspects of this diet. What are the key components that really make it work? Because you could be on 800 calories of
absolutely
crappy food, right?
So
go ahead.
The important thing is basically to have a nutritionally balanced diet. And I've employed Dr. Sarah Schrenker, who is one of the UK's leading nutritionists, to create the menus. And people have been reporting back, they find them really delicious and really filling. So it's, you know, it's rich in good proteins, plenty of eggs, plenty of fish, plenty of meat, and also vegetarian options. There's lots of vegetables there, fruit, but not the sort of sweet fruit, the Mediterranean fruit, so it's much more sort of apples and berries, which are have a much lower glycemic index, if you like. There are grains there, but they're whole grains, so you don't get that big, you know, boost in blood sugar levels. There's dairy there because things like yogurt, particularly full-fat yogurt and cheese, have been unfairly demonized, because it turns out now that full-fat yogurt is much, much healthier than the stuff you buy, which is low-fat, which tends to be stuffed with sugar. So it has things like that in it. The recipes are actually very delicious, and as I said, if people come to the website, they can see more recipes there, but what I'd love people to do is come and contribute their own recipes. And in my experience, what I've found, I also put myself on the diet because I never recommend something I wouldn't try myself. And I found after a couple of days, I felt fine on it. I didn't feel hungry. I felt perfectly satisfied. And you can either have it as kind of 3 meals a day or 2 meals a day, because there is some evidence. Some people find actually eating 2 meals a day more satisfying than eating 3. One of the worst ideas ever was the idea of having lots of small meals. You know, that turned out to be a dreadful, dreadful idea, and all the research has shown that it's better to have less meals and to forego the snacks if you can. The snacking simply makes you hungry. And also you need periods of time when you haven't got food in your system, but it's during those periods that your body gets on with a lot of the essential repairs.
I was going to say, you know, people often when they think of 800 calories, they in their minds they think, oh my God, it's a starvation diet. But in actual fact, and you have some fantastic photos, photographs actually, which I think are great because it reassures people. You see these plates really filled with food, and I've done some low calorie eating with nutritious foods, and it's amazing how quickly you feel satisfied when you have a dish that has, as you said, it has the healthy foods in it, but it really fills you up. It's like you're getting this nutrition, especially if you can eat more slowly. You know,
absolutely. Eat slowly. Also eat more olive oil and other fats. The fats will satiate you. They have calories, but they're actually much more satisfying. You could, as you say, you could do 800 calories on a bar of chocolate, but you would just go crazy on it and also be incredibly unhealthy. The other thing I would say is you absolutely must eat adequate amounts of protein, because protein is the one food source your body does not store. It will store fat, it will store sugar, it does not store protein. And it doesn't really use protein as a fuel source. It uses it to create, you know, the cells that your body requires. It uses it to create your immune cells, all sorts of other cells. So if your body, if you're not getting adequate protein in your diet, and that's why I'm not a fan of juicing diets unless you have adequate protein alongside. If you're not getting adequate protein, then your body will cannibalize itself. It will look for protein from your muscles and from your heart, which is not a good thing, because you do need to kind of, you know, maintain your muscle mass. This diet is very good for just losing fat rather than fat and muscle. But I also have an exercise component to it, because you've got to kind of keep up that side of things as well.
So I think that's a really important point, number one. You want to lose the fat, but you don't want to lose your muscle mass, which happens in most dieting programs, because you're just restricting calories of all sorts, not the right ones, and not adding the appropriate ones. And once you lose muscle mass, you really are compromising your health. Your bones are aging more rapidly. I mean, you can't repair or regenerate, so you don't want to lose your muscle mass. It's the fat
we're
after. So
In the trials of this, they measured the muscle mass before and at the end of 8 weeks, and the muscle loss was minimal. They used a thing called a DEXA scan, which is a way of accurately measuring the proportion of muscle fat and things like that in your body. And, they found at the end that they had preserved the vast majority of the muscle mass, which is, as you say, very rare in most diets.
And the other thing is that I have a lot of concern for people who are choosing to go on a vegetarian or a vegan diet because of that very reason. They often tend to have low protein intake and sometimes low fat intake, which ultimately does not serve their health in the long run.
Absolutely, I'm with you there. And so that's the challenge if you're a vegetarian or a vegan, where you're going to get it from. You can get it, obviously, if you're a vegetarian from eggs, from tofu, from other sources. But it's obviously slightly trickier getting adequate, good quality protein. Nuts are reasonably nutritious when it comes to protein. And again, what I'm doing is trying to create a section on the website, and I'm hoping to write a kind of a more vegetarian focused recipe book, because I do, you know, realize an awful lot of people do embrace the vegetarian way of life, and for I can understand the reasons, particularly from an ethical point of view, but it is more challenging if you are a vegetarian, making sure that you have adequate protein.
So what I really want to make people aware of is that the program you've developed in your latest book, the 8-week blood sugar diet book, is to help people who are wanting to heal from diabetes, who are showing up with pre-diabetes conditions, but it's really for anyone who wants to lose weight or just do something to support their health overall, because we know restricting calories, as you have written, has played a big role in helping people to heal and rejuvenate.
Absolutely, 100%. And what's very interesting is that an 800-calorie diet, although it sounds low, is not super low. It's at the lower end of a low-calorie diet. But what the research shows is that if you want to lose weight, then actually losing it quite fast is going to be more effective than losing it slow. There was a big study recently done in Australia at Melbourne University, and they took 200 overweight people, and they said to them, either lose the weight fast, around 800 calories, and try and lose about 12.5% of your body weight in the next 8 to 10 weeks, or do it more slowly and gradually, a pound a week or so, and do it over 36 weeks. And what they found is the group who were doing it slow, the dropout rate was really high. About half of them gave up before they hit their target, because they just got bored, frustrated, whatever. Nearly 90% of those who were on the fast diet, they hit their target. And what was interesting was 2 years later, as they followed them, the group who had put on more weight were the people who'd lost the weight slowly. So they were not only less likely to achieve their target, but they actually were more likely to put the weight back on, which is not what most people believe. But that's consistent with a very large number of studies which have been done down the year. And again, this is one of those myths which is out there, which every nutritionist will repeat to you, that, you know, it's really important to lose it slowly and gradually, otherwise you put it all back on. But it's not supported by the science. Though I also say you have to make sure that if you're going to lose weight, you know, fast on an 800-calorie diet, that you have all the right nutrients. Because if you go on a kind of crazy diet, you can just lose huge amounts of muscle, which will do you no good at all.
Do you recommend doing any supplementation with this protocol?
I think it's not a bad idea. I personally don't supplement, because I haven't found something that really kind of works for me, but it's going to do you no harm at all taking a multivitamin. I think the evidence around vitamins is quite mixed in terms of the overall, you know, level of benefit if you are eating otherwise healthily. One of the shocking truths is that in our culture, where most people get their vitamins from are from bread and cereal, the vitamins which they're fortified with. I was talking to a nutritionist, and she said the trouble with kids now is if you took away the cereal, the sugary cereal, which is probably pretty bad for them, and got them to eat healthier things like eggs, they might well then become vitamin deficient, but they're not getting adequate vitamins anywhere else. So they're utterly dependent now on the vitamins that are manufactured in some factory in Switzerland and then stuck in the bread and the cereals. And I think that's a bit of a shocking indictment of our society, that we have become so malnourished in terms of the foods we eat, that we are reliant on eating cereal to keep ourselves in good health, inverted commas, don't you? I do find that very, very shocking.
And you really have to question how effective those really, really synthetic vitamins are that are
completely
put into this.
Because most of the evidence is that supplementing with, you know, eating good food is a really important way of getting vitamins, but it comes in a complex package. And what we know from many studies which have been done just supplementing, supplements alone don't work. I mean, we know, for example, if you eat a carrot, the carrot has beta-carotene in it. That is shown to be good for health. So they thought, okay, let's create a pill with beta-carotene in, and we'll give it to smokers and see what that does. And it turned out when they did it in a big trial, they had to stop the trial early because the people getting the beta-carotene supplement, they were dying faster. And it turns out that if you take beta-carotene supplements, your body responds by basically switching off the absorption of beta-carotene from other foods. And when it stops absorbing beta-carotene, it also stops absorbing other things. So it turned out that taking the beta-carotene capsules was positively bad for you. That's kind of the danger of a lot of this reductionist thinking, that actually when people put it into proper trials and they look at it, it doesn't work. Something which obviously works in food doesn't work so well when you take it out of food or when you just add it to food. So I think that's one of the things that we are slowly learning.
Yeah, and, you know, I mean, if you're going to get cheap vitamins out of the drugstore, it's different than if you get formulas that really have higher quality and well-researched. You know, as a naturopath, I really see those differences as well. You kind of get what you pay for when it comes.
I know. I'm just in the chemist now, and I was looking at melatonin because I've got jet lag at the moment, and I find melatonin quite effective. And I was trying to, you know, there were 15 different brands of melatonin. I have no idea which ones actually have the best active ingredient on them. Because I also, I host a series in for the BBC in the UK called Trust Me, I'm a Doctor. And we recently looked at supplements and we looked at various forms of alternative medicine. And when we tested them, most of the products did not have what they said on the side. They, in many cases, they had none of the active ingredient at all.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
In some cases, they had other dangerous components which they did not advertise. Because in the UK, certainly, it is a completely unregulated industry. And that kind of is very difficult.
Yeah, which is always shocking to hear because people put their trust in those things. And again, it's you have to know what you're doing and you have to know what the quality products are. Otherwise, you could be wasting your money.
So broadly, I'm in favor of, you know, going for good food. If you take good, unprocessed food, you can't go far wrong.
And in the U.S., it really needs to be as organic as possible.
Yes, I mean, very interesting studies done. Big debate, for example, around meat. Is meat good for you? Is it bad for you? And what's interesting is the studies done in America have consistently shown that people who eat lots of meat, quite high levels of meat, that's associated with increased risk of bowel cancer and heart disease. But similar studies carried out in Europe and in Japan show quite the reverse, that actually meat eating seems to be associated with better health, at least moderate meat eating. And they think the main reason is that in the U.S., an awful lot of cattle are fed on corn, they're fed on antibiotics, which are banned in Europe, and they're also fed on growth hormone. Whereas in the UK, in Europe, and in Japan, the cattle are fed on grass. And so
right.
The sort of essential fatty acids, the things you get out of the meat, are completely different in Europe than those in the States. And I suspect that's what, you know, explains the huge discrepancies in the trials.
Right, I would think so. And the corn is GMO corn, of course.
Of course, and corn is generally not a great thing. I mean, one of the tragedies is that in the States, in particular, you subsidize the sort of foods which are incredibly unhealthy for you. So the foods, you know, nobody subsidizes asparagus or carrots, but they do subsidize corn, which is fantastically fattening and bad for you on so many levels, and you get the, you know, fructose, corn syrups and things like that, which we know are really bad for the liver and get converted by the liver into fat. And that stuff is heavily subsidized by the U.S. government and therefore by the U.S. citizens. And at some level, you go, that's mad. We've just introduced a sugar tax in the UK. I've been banging on about it with the food celebrity Jamie Oliver. We've been campaigning on this for some time, and they've just introduced it last week, which I was pleased about. So they're putting sugar tax on sugary drinks.
It'll be interesting if it yields any results.
Absolutely, because they've done it in Mexico, where it seems to be very effective. And hopefully if it kind of has an effect in the UK, then it will add to the sort of groundswell of argument around the world in places like Australia and the States. It may provide compelling evidence that governments actually need to act. And I do think, you know, going back to type 2 diabetes, we have a huge and growing problem which urgently needs action at so many different levels. And that's kind of why I wrote the book. It's partly a wake-up call to people to go, there's a problem, there's a high chance you have the problem, and you may not know it because you can be, you know, normal weight and still have prediabetes because a third of people who are type 2 diabetics are normal weight. They have a BMI less than 25. And if you're Asian or you are Afro-Caribbean or you're, in fact, anything other than Caucasian, then your risk is hugely increased and you will develop it at a younger age. You will then develop it more aggressively. So that's kind of why I'm banging on. And the problem is, for women, is it's carried on down the generations. Because if you develop gestational diabetes, which is quite common now, you develop diabetes during pregnancy, you'll perhaps have a large baby. That baby will be at hugely greater risk of becoming overweight and diabetic in turn. And you will also have a hugely greater risk if you develop gestational diabetes of becoming a type 2 diabetic. So we're handing it down the generations now, because once a woman passes it on to the child, there are changes also in the DNA, it's a grim old story. So in a single generation, things have changed radically, and I think it's going to take, you know, concerted work to bring us back, because this is a really serious epidemic. I mean, I have no doubt that diabetes is the greatest public health threat that faces us. When I say us, I really do mean the world.
Yes. So let's talk about what you were presenting recently at the Sydney Opera House. I know you were in Australia, and you gave a lecture there to women predominantly, I believe, in the audience. And you were talking about some of the concerns and this relationship of diabetes and increased risk of breast cancer. Just spiking your blood sugar and increasing your insulin levels becomes a risk factor for breast cancer. Being overweight becomes a risk factor. So can we talk a little bit about that?
Absolutely, because it was a great meeting, and there were several hundred women there, and they were just a great audience, and it was wonderful being in Sydney, I have to say. So I was talking about that. I was talking about the fact that insulin is this critical hormone. It's a very old hormone, and most people kind of, if they've heard about it, associated it with simply bringing your blood sugar levels down. Now we know it does so much more than that. It does, as I think I mentioned, also lead to fat storage, and it drives your risk of breast cancer, because what it does is it's like kind of putting your foot on the accelerator in your car. It basically makes everything turn over much, much faster. So women should be wary and should be aware of what's happening to their insulin levels, because if they are elevated, they will put you at much greater risk. So research has shown that doing the 5-2 diet, the fast diet as I described, will increase your insulin sensitivity. Basically, that means that your body will produce less insulin, and that's a good thing, because you want to keep the levels lower. And this 800-calorie diet will also dramatically reduce your insulin production. In fact, in the studies where they did it, they found that over 8 weeks, within the first few days, your blood sugar levels started to fall. Over 8 weeks, there was a 33-pound weight loss on average. But insulin levels fell to about a third. They fell. They were two-thirds lower at the end of 8 weeks than they were at the beginning. So they saw a massive drop in insulin. And that is really important, because it meant that these women were no longer hungry all the time. But it also meant that they were at significantly reduced risk of both breast cancer and dementia, both of which are driven by high levels of insulin.
Which is pretty scary because of the obesity rates and the majority of the population is overweight. It's driving breast cancer. And, of course, being overweight is generating more inflammation and more estrogen by those fat cells. So you're just fueling a fire here.
Absolutely. And, the standard advice from doctors for decades has been eat low fat. Well, they did the study, the Women's Health Initiative, which I described earlier, probably the most expensive trial ever carried out, 80,000 women on a low-fat diet, and at the end of 8 years, no effect whatsoever on breast cancer risk. Conversely, going on the Mediterranean diet, which I describe in my book, they found that it reduced your breast cancer risk by 68%. So if I was a woman, I know which one I would much rather be on. Plus, Mediterranean diet is so much tastier. Unfortunately, it's not pasta and pizza, but it is plenty of really sort of tasty olive oil, nuts, and other ingredients. And all the recipes in my book are based on Mediterraneanizing your diet, turning it much more into this healthy, wholesome sort of diet where you will feel satiated, you will feel full, you will get the full range of, essential vitamins and minerals, and you won't need to take it in a supplement form because you'll be getting it all in your food. So, I have absolutely no doubt that this is a very safe and effective way of healing and getting yourself back to a sort of normal pre-insulin balance where you are no longer insulin resistant and you no longer have those kind of mad sugar cravings that we're all familiar with.
So what do people do after they finish the 8-week program?
Right. So I have a sort of detailed section in the book about the sort of things you need to do. The first one is obviously to stick to a Mediterranean-style diet. You will obviously be increasing your calories. In fact, I suggest you no longer need to calorie count because you will have a reduced appetite anyway. But there are two other really important components. And one is to the exercise component, and the other is reducing stress levels. Because we know stress is a major driver of hunger and that sort of, reaching for the donut. Now, what happens when you get stressed is you get elevated levels of the hormone cortisol. And what cortisol does is it drives your blood sugar levels up. Because in the ancient times, if you were a caveman or woman and you were attacked by a saber-toothed tiger and your stress levels shot up, you wanted lots of blood sugar in order to fuel your flight. The trouble is, in modern times, we get stressed, but we have nowhere to go with that stress. So what happens instead is our blood sugar levels soar upwards, our insulin levels soar upwards, the blood sugar comes crashing down, we are sad, we're unhappy, and what we want above anything else is kind of a donut or a bit of cake or something to make us feel better. And so when we get stressed, we reach for those carby, rubbishy foods, and we eat them, and then we feel terrible. But they don't make us feel better. They make us feel worse in the long term. The other thing that happens is that when we're stressed, we sleep badly. And when we sleep badly, that's strongly associated with weight gain. And it's partly because people kind of wake up in the night and snack, but also because, again, that builds up on the stress. So I have a big section in the book about how to reduce your stress. And the way I recommend you do it is by a thing called mindfulness, which I write about. And mindfulness, I've kind of done programs on this. I made television programs. I've looked at all sorts of ways of reducing stress. And I found this is by far the most effective way to do it. It's kind of 10 minutes. It's something that all the great religions have practiced. Buddhists have been very keen on it, but also the contemplative tradition of the Christians, the Jewish tradition, Hindus. Everyone has had this sort of moment where you listen to your breathing, where you may pray, you may reach for a higher power, you may simply sit there and kind of contemplate yourself and sort of feel the weight of your bottom on the chair. There are many ways of doing it, and there are some superb apps out there which I talk about. But just choosing 10 minutes in the day in which you sit down and you have a moment of quiet reflection, there's been lots of studies which have shown that this can significantly bring your stress levels down. And so I think it's a brilliant way of reducing stress and improving sleep. And I also, in the book, I write about common sort of mental pitfalls that people fall into. when they're sort of dieting or indeed afterwards. And one of the commonest is called catastrophic thinking. And what happens is, for example, you know, you eat a donut, you have a bit of cake, because we all do. We all, you know, we're human. And then you start thinking, oh, no, I've eaten the cake, I've broken my diet, I'm a failure, I'll never lose weight, oh, why do I always fail, I might as well eat the whole cake. And then in the sort of, you know, the grips of self-loathing, you then just go and stuff your face with all the rest of the cake. Now, if you can say to yourself at that moment when you've had the cake, you say to yourself, no, okay, I'm weak, I'm human, these things happen, I forgive myself. And you either give away the cake, you throw away the cake, you stick it in the freezer, you do something. But essentially you say, just because I've failed this once does not make me a failure. It's just something that happened, moving on. And that's a kind of way of readjusting your mental thinking. Because many people who are overweight blame themselves. And you really shouldn't do this. This is not your fault. This is the product of a metabolism which has come wrong. It is the fault of the people who surround you, the companies that are flogging you dodgy foods full of absolute garbage, and, you know, people who kind of prey on your feelings of guilt about being overweight. It's not your fault, but there is something powerful you can do about it. You can lose weight. You can take control of your health. It is really important to keep that thought at the forefront of your brain. And again, the other thing I would urge you to do is join a group. You can come to my website. I'm very keen that people join in because there is overwhelming evidence that if you become part of a group and you meet like-minded souls and they support you and you support them, that is incredibly healthy. And that will get you through the tough times. It is really hard losing weight, keeping it off, changing habits, becoming healthier, practicing mindfulness, doing exercise. Changing in any way is tough. I mean, I really know. I found it a struggle to lose, you know, the 20 pounds. But I have managed to keep it off. Now I find it relatively easy. And occasionally, you know, I love chocolate. If chocolate's there in my house, I'll eat it. So in my household, they have to hide it. The kids know if they leave it out, I'll eat it. So I kind of give it to my wife. She hides it, and occasionally she brings it out and lets me have some.
She gives you a treat when you've been good.
Give me a treat, exactly. And otherwise, if it's there, I'd eat it. If there's, I have no willpower at 11 o'clock at night, you know. This stuff has been carefully manufactured to make it absolutely irresistible. You know, it's been designed by very, very clever scientists. All this food, this junk food, is there designed to make you eat more and more and more. So if it's in the house, I'm going to eat it. So that's one of my rules. It's not in the house. It just isn't. And so I have a section at the end of the book about how to kind of keep on the straight and narrow, if you like. Because without a doubt, it's a challenge. But it can be done. It absolutely can be done. And you need to keep it at the forefront of your mind. You know, this is about, it's not about aesthetics. It's not about just losing weight for its own sake. It's not about, you know, fitting into your genes. It's about wanting to lead a healthy, productive life for maybe another 10, 20, 30 years and not go on, you know, dozens of drugs and not become kind of depressed and overweight. It's about taking control of your life. And I absolutely, passionately believe that each one of us is capable of that.
Well, I think we get your passion, Dr. Michael Mosley. You know, your book is such an inspiration. I do want to encourage everyone to pick up a copy, The 8-Week Blood Sugar Diet, and go to the bloodsugardiet.com website that is there to provide you with more information, inspiration, and support. We have just a couple of minutes left. Do you have any last words of wisdom for us?
I think that it is quite important that people, if they are at risk, and in the book I have a sort of quiz which you can go and fill in and find out how at risk you are, pre-diabetes and type 2 diabetes, because most people are aware that having a high levels of fat in your blood, cholesterol score, things like that, they kind of know about. Very few people are aware of what their blood sugar levels are, or indeed what the catastrophic consequences of having high blood sugar levels are. But 90% of people who are pre-diabetic are unaware of it. So there are kind of kits you can go and buy from the chemist, or you can have your doctor go and measure things. So if you find you are at risk, and as I said, some of the risk factors include having a diabetic parent or having a waist size over 35 inches or being over the age of 50, these are typical ones, then it would be worth finding out, because it is much better to act sooner. If you're a pre-diabetic and you lose about 10% of your body weight, then you can cut the risk of becoming diabetic by 90%. And even if you lose a little bit of weight, you can significantly reduce your risk of becoming type 2 diabetic. If you are type 2 diabetic, you can massively reduce the risk of becoming worse, and you may well be able to reverse it. Most people can. And it's never too late, but it's better to start sooner. So I do urge you to kind of be aware of the risks, address them, do something about it sooner rather than later. And really, you know, good health to everyone. I'm very pleased that we're here talking about it, because I think it is so important. And I think there are so few outlets at the moment, people who are genuinely interested and informed in the way that you are about the importance of food and the right foods and things like that.
Well, we really get your passion and your sincerity. So I really want to thank you, because you're making a difference throughout the world. And as always, Dr. Michael Mosley, it's such a pleasure and an inspiration to have you on the show. Thank you for joining us today.
Thanks. Travis.
And to all of you listening, thank you for joining me today. And remember, always honor the wisdom of your feminine self. Bye for now.